This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. David Sedaris has developed a passionate following for his funny autobiographical essays and his terrific readings. Sedaris is now a regular contributor to the public radio program This American Life. He's back on the bestseller list with the new paperback edition of his book Me Talk Pretty One Day. Director Wayne Wong is adapting the book into a film with Matthew Broderick slated to star as Sedaris. Me Talk Pretty One Day includes several pieces about Sedaris's recent move to France, where he's been struggling to learn the language. The book is dedicated to his father, about whom David says, "You wouldn't seek him out for advice on a personal problem, but he'd be the first one you'd call when the dishwasher broke or someone flushed a hairpiece down your toilet." David's father was also a jazz fan, and he encouraged his kids to take music lessons. Although David's only music ambition was to be a song stylist like Billie Holiday, he briefly took guitar lessons from a midget named Mr. Mancini. Here's a reading about that from the interview we recorded last year when the book was published in hardcover.
My voice shaking, I told him that I had absolutely no interest in mastering the guitar. What I really wanted was to sing in the voice of Billie Holiday. Mainly commercials, but not for banks or car dealerships, because those are usually choral arrangements. The color ebbed from my teacher's face. I told him I'd been working up an act and could use a little accompaniment. Did he know the jingle for the new Sara Lee campaign? "You want me to do what?" He wasn't angry, just confused. I felt certain he was lying when he denied knowing the tune. Double Mint Gum, Ritz Crackers, the theme songs for Alka-Seltzer and Kenmore Appliances. He claimed ignorance on all counts. I knew that it was queer to sing in front of someone, but greater than my discomfort was the hope that he might recognize what I thought of as my great talent, the one musical trick I was able to pull off. I started in on an a cappella version of the latest Oscar Mayer commercial, hoping he might join in once the spirit moved him. It looked bad, I knew, but in order to sustain the proper mood, I needed to disregard his company and sing the way I did at home alone in my bedroom, my eyes shut tight and my hands dangling like pointless, empty gloves. I sang that my baloney had a first name. I added that my baloney had a second name and concluded with, "Oh, I love to eat it every day. And if you ask me why, I'll say that Oscar Mayer has a way with B-O-L-O-G-N-A." I reached the end of my tune thinking he might take this as an opportunity to applaud or maybe even apologize for underestimating me. Mild amusement might have been an appropriate response, but instead he held up his hands as if to stop an advancing car. "Hey, guy," he said, "you can hold it right there. I'm not into that scene." A scene? What scene? I thought I was being original. "There were plenty of screwballs like you back in Atlanta," he said. "But me, I don't swing that way. You got it? This might be your thing or whatever, but you can definitely count me out." He reached for his conch shell and stubbed out his cigarette. "I mean, come on now. For God's sakes, kid, pull yourself together." I knew then why I'd never sung in front of anyone, and why I shouldn't have done it in front of Mr. Mancini. He'd used the word screwball, but I knew what he really meant. He meant I should have named my guitar Doug or Brian, or better yet, taken up the flute. He meant that if we're defined by our desires, I was in for a lifetime of trouble.
And that's David Sedaris reading from his new collection, Me Talk Pretty One Day. David, you know, I love that story, and I had to have you read it so that you could do your Billie Holiday thing. You know, reading that made me wonder if there was a lot you had to hide as a kid because you were gay and it wasn't a good thing to let people know that.
Well, it was pretty much the last thing that you wanted to be if you were, I don't know, growing up that time in North Carolina, or maybe it's still that way for kids growing up today, is that you just think it'll change tomorrow. I'm just this way today, but tomorrow it will change, and that it has to be your secret. But what's so funny is then you look back and you see in family photographs, or I should have just had the word queen tattooed on my forehead. I wasn't fooling anybody. You don't wear your mother's pantyhose and think that your parents are going to mistake you for a heterosexual, but At that time, you think, oh, I'm clever, and that they'll never know.
So did cover-ups and lying become necessary and commonplace in your life when you were young?
Yes. Oh, yes. I mean, you had to hide what it was that you were really doing and what you were really thinking. But the thing is, in my family, I probably didn't need to hide it at all. I think that because I wasn't fooling anybody, I don't think that they would have really had any sort of a problem with it.
But the outside world might have.
The outside world, yeah. But my mother was kind of one of those people that if you could buy a kit and how to make your child a homosexual, she would have bought that kit. Because it means your child's not going to be a juvenile delinquent and that they're going to wind up, you know, probably, you know, spending some money on your Mother's Day present and be a good... if your son is gay, you don't really worry about him. Oh, you certainly don't worry about him, like, marrying a woman who you're not going to like, but you don't worry about him getting into trouble.
One of the stories in your new collection, Me Talk Pretty One Day, is about your earlier life before you were a writer as a conceptual artist and performance artist. And I'd like you to read an excerpt of that story.
Sure. The story is called 12 Moments in the Life of the Artist, and it's split into 12 different chapters. And this is the fifth chapter. 5. My sister Gretchen was leaving for the Rhode Island School of Design just as I was settling back into Raleigh. After a few months in my parents' basement, I took an apartment near the State University where I discovered both crystal methamphetamine and conceptual art. Either one of these things is dangerous, but in combination they have the potential to destroy entire civilizations. The moment I took my first burning snootful, I understood that this was a drug for me. Speed eliminates all doubt. Am I smart enough? Will people like me? Do I really look all right in this plastic jumpsuit? These are questions for insecure potheads. A speed enthusiast knows that everything he says or does is brilliant. The upswing is that, having eliminated the need for both eating and sleeping, you have a full 24 hours a day to spread your charm and talent. For God's sakes, my father would say, it's 2 o'clock in the morning. What are you calling for? I was calling because the rest of my friends had taken to unplugging their phones after 10 p.m. These were people I'd known in high school, and it disappointed me to see how little we now had in common. They were still talking about pen and ink portraits and couldn't understand my desire to drag a heavy cash register through the forest. I hadn't actually done it, but it sounded like a good idea to me. These people were all stuck in the past, setting up their booths in the art fair and thinking themselves successful because they'd sold a silk screen of a footprint in the sand. It was sad, in a way. Here they were, struggling to make art, while without the least bit of effort, I was living art. My socks balled up on the hardwood floor made a greater statement than any of their hokey claptrap with the carefully matted frames and big curly signatures in the lower left-hand corners. Didn't they read any of the magazines? The new breed of artists wanted nothing to do with my sister's idea of beauty. Here were people who made a living pitching tents or lying in a fetal position before our national monuments. One fellow had made a name for himself by allowing a friend to shoot him in the shoulder. This was the art world I'd been dreaming of, where God-given talent was considered an unfair advantage, and a cold-blooded stare merited more praise than the ability to render human flesh. Everything around me was art, from the stains in my bathtub to the razor blade and short length of drinking straw I used to ingest and cut my speed. I was back in the world with a clear head and a keen vision of just how talented I really was.
David, is there a piece that you did during that period that you could describe for us?
You know, the thing is, my performance art was just so vacant and just so formulaic. Like, if I talk about plays that I've done, I can recall them because the plays had a story. But this was like the worst sort of performance art because it told no story whatsoever. It was all prop driven. It was that sort of thing where you bring out like 15 objects and the audience just sits there and waits while you go through the rubber boot and while you go through the inflatable shark and while you go through the aspirin bottle filled with BBs. And the part of what made it so horrible was this notion that it was the audience's job to figure out the meaning. It wasn't your job. Your job was to just get up there with a sort of a slack expression on your face and, I don't know, cut your hair with garden shears. That was all you really needed to do. I did that for a couple of years, and I look back and, gee, I am so embarrassed over some of the things that I did. And of course, I was just high as I could be the entire time, which convinced me that what I was doing was actually brilliant.
But as embarrassed as you are about the pieces that you did then, I bet there was something really liberating in a good way about your conceptual art and performance art period.
No, there was nothing liberating about it. It was just torment, and I just tortured everybody around me. Everybody around me, and forcing my family to come and watch me in these horrible, horrible spectacles. And it wasn't really until I dropped out of college, and I was living in Raleigh when I discovered speed and conceptual art. And then I went back to school when I was 27. And then I was in art school, and I would watch people do these performances. And then I was able to really sort of clearly see for the first time just how unfun it is to sit in the audience, because it's all just about you being a performer. You don't really think about people in the audience. With a play, you think about people in the audience, and you think, are they going to get this story? Are they going to be bored? Are they going to walk out? And you sort of tailor what you're doing to those concerns. Whereas with performance art, you could just convince yourself that if people didn't get it, they were stupid. And you would think, well, who wouldn't want to watch me take a nap? who wouldn't want to see that?
So what was the actual turning point when you decided to give up your performance art?
When I ran out, my drug dealer moved to another state, and I did not have any speed left. And it was all I could do just to really to get out of bed. I've always been fond of drugs, but I don't think I'd ever been really hooked on anything before. And you don't really know you're hooked until you don't get your drugs anymore, and then you go through a withdrawal. And it was, I think, coming through the withdrawal from that, I thought, well, that part of my life is over. It's completely over, and it's time to try something new.
Is that when you started writing, or were you already writing?
I was already writing, and then I just sort of moved into that more or less full-time, into the writing, rather than into the... Well, I went on to go to art school, but when I was in art school, it was mainly for painting and for sculpture. And I didn't do any performance art while I was in school.
How much talent did you have for, say, representational painting and sculpture?
I have no talent whatsoever. No talent whatsoever. If I was a courtroom sketch artist, it would look like drawings of a five-year-old. All the characters would have really big heads, and they would either smile or frown. It would be like those drawings that children do after they've been abused or whatever, with the angry mommy or the happy mommy. They would be drawings like that. I can't draw anything.
My guest is David Sedaris. His book, Me Talk Pretty One Day, has just come out in paperback. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is humorist David Sedaris. His book, Me Talk Pretty One Day, has just come out in paperback. Why did you want to be an artist if you felt you had so little talent for it?
I wanted to be an artist just from when I was young and reading books and biographies, and I had the idea that you would be an artist and it would just be very romantic, and you would live in a garret and you would have a closet full of berets. And it was enough to keep me going until the age of 28, this romantic notion.
So what you wanted was the artist's life, maybe more so than the art itself?
I wanted the artist's life, and I wanted to live in a studio and filled with naked men, you know, who would be posing for me. I would chisel them out of marble. And then I saw myself, like, wearing long scarves and going to museum openings. But I just could never see the work itself. That was a problem.
So when you took writing more seriously and gave up painting and sculpture and performance art, did you fashion a kind of artist life for yourself as a writer? Did you see the possibilities for that?
No, strangely, I never did. But with writing, I was just, I would just notice how, when I was doing artwork, how I could look at something and walk away from it and just forget it. Whereas there would be certain stories that I would read that I would be haunted by, and I would read them over and over and over again until I memorized them. And I just noticed that the words had power over me, whereas visual art genuinely didn't. I think I just got into it because nothing else worked. I tried being an actor. I was horrible. I tried performance art. I stunk. I tried visual art. I was terrible. I'm just lucky I found writing before I went through a dance phase.
The funny thing is, though, that there is a whole romance around writing, just as there is a whole romance around the life of the visual artist. And I'm surprised kind of that you didn't hook into that romanticized vision of the writer.
No, I guess because I've always read a lot of biographies, and you always just read about writers wind up, you know, they wind up being really drunk and calling their friends until their friends don't answer the phone. Like Jean Stafford, she was one of those writers who wound up just a mess. And her last project, she had an idea for a book called Cooking for One While Drunk. So I never thought of a rosy ending to a writing life.
Now, you said that crystal methamphetamine was your drug of choice because it was so good at eliminating doubts and make you feeling really confident and good about yourself and your work. What were some of the doubts you needed to eliminate that were very inhibiting for you?
That I had no talent whatsoever, and that what I was doing was absolutely meaningless, and that everybody was laughing at me instead of admiring me because I came up with these great things that they couldn't understand. Speed pretty much eliminates any doubt that you would have. You know, you look like a million bucks. You're incredibly bright. I look back at my diary during that time, and I would easily write 10 pages a night. And it's just awful, just awful. There's not a single sentence in there worth salvaging. And then if that's what I wrote down, when I think what came out of my mouth was probably even worse.
When you stopped taking speed, did the old doubts come back, the doubts that you were suppressing with the speed?
Oh, yes, they came back. Oh, they came back immediately, only stronger.
Well, how did you deal with those doubts in your writing?
With the writing, it seems much easier to deal with those doubts because you can confront them honestly. And also, you're telling a story. There was something about that whole period where narrative was bad. Narrative was a bad thing. To tell people a story was cheap and easy.
So it was just... Like when you started writing, was there a kind of experimental fiction that was the equivalent of performance art?
Yes, but I noticed I never read those things.
Right.
And I didn't feel any... You know, like sometimes you're young and you go through a certain phase and you pretend to like these things that you can't bear. You pretend to like these movies that are just... In fact, they're just a bore, but you think that if you say that they're boring, then everyone's going to think you're stupid. But I noticed that I would never subject myself to reading things that didn't have the story, that didn't satisfy me. And I felt okay in saying, that's not for me. And so luckily I never went through that phase.
So the doubts that came back after you stopped the crystal meth and started writing, it sounds like those are doubts that you were able to incorporate into the writing, that you were in part writing about the doubts so you could describe them instead of suppressing them?
Yes, and they were very helpful that way. Because really, that's basically all I have to talk about is my doubts. And denied that, gee, you just pour styrofoam pellets into a rubber boot and empty them into a pail and call it a night.
You're living in France. How long have you been there?
I've been there for as almost 2 years.
Uh-huh. And what brought you to France? Why did you leave New York?
Smoking. You can smoke wherever you want to in France. And it's heaven that way. All those European countries, they should just represent them on maps with big ashtrays. I recorded a book on tape in New York, my last book. I recorded it on tape here, and you had to leave the building. You had to go down 8 floors in order to have a cigarette. And I recorded the new book on tape in Paris, and there were 2 standing ashtrays right in the recording booth, which was the size of a closet.
What's it like for you, who is so verbal and so defined by your language, to function in a country where you can't do what most defines you, which is speak? I mean, I think your French is probably still fairly rudimentary. And so it's hard, I'm sure, for you to communicate with a lot of the people there.
That's my incentive, though, to learn, because, you know, it drives me crazy to sit there and have to keep my mouth shut. It drives me absolutely out of my mind. So that's been my biggest incentive to learn. But it's hard. You know, we'll go to dinner sometimes, and he speaks French perfectly, and he's got a lot of French friends, and we'll go to dinner at their house, and at one end of the table, everybody is laughing and engaging in sparkling conversation. And I just see the guests at my end of the table saying, "I had to sit next to him the last time." Everyone on the other side of the table, they're having a ball. And on my end of the table, it's me saying, "I saw a rabbit in the road yesterday, and he was happy." That's what I have to bring to the table. I talk like Yoda, basically. And now my verbs are, I'm getting my verbs down. And that makes it a lot easier, because you can't, some exhaust people a little bit less than I did before. I just try to be the most cheerful person in the country. That's how I go about it.
Well, David Sedaris, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
David Sedaris recorded last year. His book, Me Talk Pretty One Day, has just come out in paperback. The book is being adapted into a film by director Wayne Wong. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.